in-depth coverage from an alternative perspective. As part of this coverage, we are launching a new Eyes on the Street feature where Vancouverites will have a chance to tell their Olympic story. We want to hear your perspective of life in Vancouver during the Games. Be CITR's Eyes on the Street this February. If you are at an event, a protest, a celebration, or even simply on the bus, tell us about it. There are three ways to file a report. Call our Eyes on the Street hotline at 604-822-5334, email news@citr.ca, or tweet CITR News. Then sit back and wait for your report to be featured on the next edition of News 101, which airs Monday and Friday at 5 p.m. right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. Now we're happy to bring you your weekly series with the fine folks from the UBISI for this week's headlines. Here's Trevor Record and Justin McElroy.
Hello, and welcome to UBISI Front Page News. I'm Justin McElroy.
And I'm Trevor Record. Here's today's headlines. UBC purchased 444 tickets for the Olympic Games, costing the university a whopping $40,690. However, of those 442 tickets, only 82 went to students. 118 went to alumni, 98 went to staff, 58 went to executives, and the Board of Governors, 34 went to athletics, and the UNA got 18.
All of the tickets were for events at the Doug Mitchell Winter Sports Center, home of men's and women's hockey during the Olympic Games and Paralympic sledge hockey during the Paralympic Games. The price of the tickets ranged from $50 to $300.
Tickets for the students were allocated through the Student Olympic Collaborative and through the VP Students Office. They were given out through raffles, draws, and contests to selected groups of students. However, BCIT and SFU raffled off all of their tickets just to students and staff members.
VP External Stephen Owen said that UBC's distribution of tickets was done fairly, calling it, quote, a really balanced availability of tickets to various parts of the UBC community.
In other news, UBC professor Chris Shaw criticized the commercial advertisement regulations surrounding the games this week. He said, the IOC are so zealous about guarding their rights that they forget there are civil liberties involved. The current bylaws restricting handing out flyers and leaflets near Olympic areas and bans authorizing commercial signs.
A UBC professor has spoken out against some controversial images in the Olympic torch promotional video. The video uses images from the 1936 torch relay in Berlin, showing a torchbearer entering the stadium during the time when the Nazi Party ruled Germany. While the original image shows people saluting to the Nazi Party, the Vanock video replaces this with a black background. Vanock said that it was to respect the relay's past without having to show any political approval of the event. However, UBC English professor Aaron Nadell said he was surprised that Vanock would do such a thing. The 1936 Olympics was the Summer Games. It wasn't even the Winter Games, he said. That's really, pardon me, idiotic.
During the next 3 weeks, the UBC will continue to publish, providing students with Olympic news. Justin McElroy is our sports editor. And Justin, what sort of things can we expect during the Games?
Well, as you mentioned, Trevor, we're going to be publishing during the 2-week reading break with our regular issues on Monday and Thursday. We're also going to be having an increase of multimedia videos and other things on our website, ubc.ca, focusing on different unique aspects of the Olympic experience that students and other Vancouver citizens can have. In addition, we got a full media accreditation pass of the Games, the only student media organization in the world to get one. And so our reporter for that, Tag Sira, will be at events ranging from alpine skiing to luge to men's hockey, filing reports, interviewing athletes, and giving a student perspective on what it's like to be right inside the games.
Well, thanks for that, Justin. And for all of us at the UBC, I'm Trevor Record. Thanks for listening.
It's time now for a public service announcement, but stay tuned for more provincial and local news. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Join Team PowerSmart. Set an energy conservation target of 10%. You'll get access to tools to help you conserve, and you can track your progress online. Visit bchydro.com/Team PowerSmart to join today. This message brought to you by BC Hydro PowerSmart and CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver.
The 8 Kids Vancouver Helpline is here to help. Open from 9 to 4, Monday to Friday, the helpline answers questions about HIV and safer sex. Call to find medical support in your area without giving your name. Run by volunteers, the helpline is one of many programs from AIDS Vancouver combating the HIV epidemic in the Lower Mainland. While not medical professionals, our volunteers answer your questions confidentially and anonymously. The helpline number is 604-696-4666 or contact us online at www.aidsvancouver.org.
Welcome back. I'm Andrew Longhurst, and you're listening to News 101, broadcasting live from the Student Union Building at UBC. Thanks for being with us tonight. The Poverty Olympics descended on Vancouver yesterday, and I was there reporting throughout the Poverty Torch Relay and Poverty Games. Here's my report. The 2010 Poverty Torch arrived in Vancouver's downtown east side on Sunday, February 7th, for the opening of the 2010 Poverty Olympics. As the Poverty Torch entered into Canada's poorest neighborhood, coming all the way from West Vancouver and across the Lionsgate Bridge, the crowd grew considerably. Activists, organizers, residents of the downtown east side, and Canadian and international media prepared for the torch's arrival. As the torch neared, one of the organizers spoke to the crowd, highlighting the goals behind the Poverty Olympics, which has been held since 2008.
The reason why we're here and the reason why we're so committed, and people have pushed that torch around the province and people have dressed up and they're going to put on a mini Olympics today, is we want to raise welfare.
Yes!
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 And we want to raise minimum wage.
Yes!
And we want to build social housing.
Yes!
And homelessness needs to end in Canada.
The Poverty Torch arrived at the Center for the Vancouver Area Network of Drug Users, which was one of a number of community groups supporting and organizing the Poverty Olympics and Torch Relay. The handmade Poverty Torch, pushed on a hospital gurney, made its way down East Hastings in style, with music, dancing, and numerous signs reading, "End Poverty Now." As we marched to the Japanese Hall, the location of the Poverty Olympics, alongside the torch, I asked people why they were taking part in the Poverty Olympics. I first spoke with downtown Eastside resident Floyd and asked him why he was attending.
The whole thing is I really, really wanted to check it out. I'm not really for or against the Olympics. I really don't know because it's not really going to affect me in any way. But apparently it's affecting a lot of people here. So I was once in a lifetime, because the Olympics, you know, I figured this was the whole reason why the Poverty Olympics came anyway, so I figured I'll check this one year out, and then really see what it's all about. It's just probably just some harmless fun, it's protesting, yeah. And it's not really, they're not out to really, like, hurt anybody, and they're just having their moments, and that's about it.
But while he admitted he wasn't for or against the Olympics, every other person I talked to expressed their frustration and anger over the games. And what's your name?
It's Cash.
And why are you here today?
I'm here to support the people in our community who are not being supported by the Olympics and who remain invisible amongst all these games.
And for you, what does the Olympics represent?
It represents a lot of greed, a lot of corporations, money that is being claimed to be spent on the city, a lot of initiatives that would not have been supported if it wasn't for the games happening, a lot of lying, and just a lot of people being invisible, and the fact that there were a lot of Olympic promises, like supported housing initiatives that were supposed to happen that have not happened, and it looks like they'll never happen, and it's really sad.
And what's your name?
It's Kat.
And why are you here today?
I'm basically here because, well, this story needs to be told, and I'm totally here to support this neighborhood, especially because we're on the downtown east side, and I have a work that actually supports people in this neighborhood, and they've been forced off of their livelihoods because of this. The police presence in this neighborhood has increased. There's $1 billion that's going towards the police presence in the city right now, and I just figure that, you know, I need to do the most I can to get their story told.
What's your name?
Curtis.
Curtis, why are you here today?
Because there's a lot of crap going on in the city, and the homeless and the people who are close to being homeless are being overlooked, and we're spending all our money on a big two-week party.
And what's your name?
Aaron.
Aaron, and why are you here today at the Poverty Olympics and the Torch Relay?
A lot of the same stuff that Curtis said, but also just to stand in solidarity with the community of the downtown east side, and just to, for them to know that people outside of their community care for them and are worried about what the coming of the Olympics has done to the community, how it has really pushed them aside and not really asked the residents here how they feel about it. There's been no community consultation about anything that ever happens.
I also spoke with Mary Ann Neal, president of the Burnaby Teachers Association. As she carried the association's banner with other teachers, she told me how angry she was that public schools are facing significant funding cuts, while the public cost for the games has been estimated to be around $6 billion.
I'm the president of the Burnaby Teachers Association, and as everyone probably knows by now, the education system is being drained of funds this year while they spend millions to dump snow on Cyprus. So as a result, the children of BC are going to suffer so that we can have 2 weeks of celebrations that most people can't afford to participate in. So that's why we're here.
I even had the opportunity to speak with one of the 2010 Poverty Olympics mascots. What Poverty Olympics mascot are you?
I'm Chewy the Rat.
Chewy the Rat. And why are you part of this Poverty Olympics protest?
Oh, well, you know, me and my entire family, there's millions of us, we all live in this neighborhood, and we love it when landlords provide bad housing because there's always garbage and bad upkeep and all that, so my family can thrive just fine. Sorry about you people.
After a 20-minute march through the downtown east side, we arrived for the opening ceremonies. After an Aboriginal welcoming and statements by organizers, the Poverty Olympics MCs, Chewy the Rat and Itchy the Bedbug, introduced the events of the Poverty Olympics. The games including housing hurdles, a miracle on ice, and wrestling for the community. The events represented political satire at its finest, as VanOck CEO John Furlong and BC Minister of Housing Rich Coleman were impersonating competing in a hockey game against ordinary British Columbians and putting their dirty tricks on full display. Following the Poverty Games, I spoke with Vancouver City Councillor Ellen Woodsworth, the only city councillor to attend the Poverty Olympics. She has been a very vocal critic of the official Olympic Games and saw the Poverty Olympics as a way of calling for a national housing strategy, as well as greater provincial support for social housing.
I think it's very important that we stand together with community groups and citizens and say if we can raise over $6 billion to host the Olympics, we can continue this and raise $6 billion to end homelessness and provide affordable housing for everyone in this country.
The 2010 Poverty Olympics are just one way that some Vancouver residents have been opposing the Games. Numerous protests and rallies are scheduled throughout the Games this February. For CITR News 101, this is Andrew Longhurst. This is News 101, and the current time is 5:20. Today the Olympic Resistance Network held a press conference at the Vancouver Art Gallery to announce the return of the lost Olympics mascot, Squatchy, now renamed Squatchy. Here's coverage of that press conference.
If you do anything, such as wear an Olympic t-shirt, you can expect a visit from the police. So they've done everything they can to discourage the public, but I think the public is wise to their tricks, and they know that this is their opportunity to come out and voice themselves about the Olympics. People aren't happy about $9 billion of public funds going to the Olympics, environmental destruction, the occupation of unceded Indigenous territory, the waste of public funds during a housing and economic crisis, and their broken promises about shelter beds and affordable housing. All those reasons and more will bring a lot of people out on the streets on Friday.
A question for Mr. Aegis here.
You want to move in?
In terms of infiltration, you've seen in the past police actually involved in demonstrations and instigating trouble. What are you expecting here?
Well, we hope through this message and other things that the police will act professionally and responsibly. We all pay taxes the same as everyone else when you're against the Olympics, and we hope they won't try some of those tactics that they've used in the past.
Do you have any reason to think that they might?
Well, they did it at Montebello. We caught three Quebec police officers trying to look like demonstrators with hoodies and kerchiefs, but we spotted them and exposed them. You know, the cops seem to have a weird thing. No matter how they dress up, they always wear the same shoes or boots, so it makes them easy to spot. I think there must be something about being police and having some kind of weird foot fetish. But we'll have our eyes open for them, and we hope that they will be responsive.
Can I just ask about having the message being heard by the public? To now, that hasn't necessarily been the case. There has been a backlash against protesters during disruptions along the torch relay. What do you do if your message, in fact, is not getting out? That seems to be the case.
People that are receptive and have an open mind about the Olympics are receiving the message. We're getting good coverage across with the torch relay across Canada. A lot of people are participating in anti-Olympics protests, and a lot of people are having their voice heard about important political issues. If a few people feel that their enjoyment of the ceremonies is being disrupted, that's unfortunate, but we have to remember that Vanock put them in that position. We didn't put them in the position. We didn't ask for the Olympics. We're dealing with something that was forced upon us.
We haven't seen any disruption of the Olympic torch relay at this point. As it gets closer to Vancouver, is that going to change? Will there be action?
The Olympic torch has been disrupted in several ways. It was disrupted on the very first day when we came around from Victoria. So the Olympic torch messaging has been successfully disrupted across the country.
I'm talking more as it comes into Vancouver. Are there any plans afoot?
There will be a gathering in Pigeon Park on the morning of the 12th when the torch will be going through the downtown east side as well. There will be some people trying to express themselves on Commercial Drive with signs and banners as it's going down the drive. I think Greg has something to say about that. And if you guys could move back a little bit, it would make this easier.
Yeah, on the matter of the torch, the torch is coming through UBC on the 11th, and between 5 and 6 p.m., there is going to be a rally there to protest the torch as well, so you should all know about that as well.
And we'll be greeting the torch in Delta tomorrow in the afternoon at Delta City Hall. But I think the real question you guys should be asking is not about this or that, what's happening with the torch. One of the reasons we're protesting is because it's sponsored by RBC, which is one of the biggest funders of the tar sands projects, which is one of the dirtiest, most polluting, and CO2 producing projects in the world. I think it's ironic that this company is sponsoring this torch relay in the Olympics, and everyone's worried about there not being any snow on Cyprus. And I think we all know that's because of global warming, and RBC and there's other companies like Petro-Can are the ones who are pushing projects like the tar sands. That's what you should be talking about, and that should be what the public should be concerned about.
You know, look, there are lots of groups that have cooperated, however you want to term it, with the Olympic organizers. I mean, you've even got people in the downtown east side who say, look, the Olympics were always going to come here. We're getting what we can get out of it. There are some agencies that have gotten some jobs. Some of them are short-term, but some of them are training for skills. I spoke to one umbrella group that's got the contract to dispose of all the Olympic assets, like $1 or $2 million worth of Olympic assets. You know, you've got the four First Nations that are opening up this pavilion later today, who say, look, you know, this has brought millions of dollars to our communities. We've got 2,000 jobs. Yes, protest is great, they say, but you know what? We're getting something out of this that otherwise wouldn't have come. What do you say to people who say, you know, protest is all well and good, but it's you know, there has been a net benefit to some of the most needy people in the city?
There's been some minor employment opportunities. Certainly there's been some business opportunities. They're making the best of a bad situation. That doesn't mean a net benefit. We cannot possibly have enough improvements to make up for the $9 billion of public funds spent on the Olympic Games, to make up for the 100,000 trees being cut down, to make up for the massive human displacement that accompanies the Olympics. There simply isn't enough gain to make it worthwhile. And it's worth pointing that out every chance we get. There might be minor gains, but they're making the best of a bad situation.
The protest seems to be a coalition of different groups. Is there any concern that some might be more willing to commit vandalism or violence than others?
Certainly there's a number of different demonstrations during the convergence, and there's a number of different tactics for people to choose at different demonstrations. This is a public traditional protest, a rally, a march, a protest. different demonstrations have different tactical agreements.
Is there any attempt to control violence or vandalism or prevent it?
We organize ourselves. We certainly don't need the police to police us. We take care of ourselves. We take care of each other. Things will be fine on Friday. You guys pretty good?
Well, we can't control the police.
Hey, I got here late. I didn't want to ask some of the same questions before. Can I maybe start with some basic questions? Or?
Well, I guess certainly, as Squatchy reminds me, if the issue of violence come up, people should remember that there's never been any violence towards humans associated with the anti-Olympic movement. If any violence is to be expected, it's definitely coming from the police. Squatchy spent some time in the downtown east side. He saw the way that the homeless are being over-ticketed in an attempt to remove them during the Olympics, that they have the power to, through the Assistance to Shelter Act, to forcibly put people into shelters. So he's more concerned about protest, about violence coming from the police than from the protesters.
What do you think of the Vancouver police's acknowledgement now that, you know, they're expecting, you know, 1,000 or more protesters on Friday? I think that was a bigger number than some people thought that, you know, the police might put out there. Is that a sign that they're taking this more seriously?
I knew they were taking it seriously when they approached me on the steps of City Hall and started interrogating me about my Olympic beliefs for speaking out against the anti-free speech bylaws. The police have been taking this seriously for a very long time, and any expectation they have about the numbers, I would not trust anything the police say about that at this point.
So what are you expecting that we'll see on Friday and at subsequent?
Community celebration. You guys have any thoughts about your expectations on Friday?
Hard to say, but I can tell you I do a lot of work in the community. The Council of Canadians is the largest public advocacy group in Canada. I work with the trade unions. Don't know if they'll all come out, but you'd be amazed at how many ordinary people are saying right on, heard about it in the press, great stuff you guys are doing. You know, 50% in the latest poll are opposed to the Olympics. They understand that we got sucked in when they put the bid. I hope thousands of them will come out. And if the press stops trying to, you know, scare people and talk about possibility of violence, just talks about the message and why we should be protesting, I think it could be really big.
So, sorry, so Squatchy has something to say on that? Sorry, what did you say? Certainly, Squatchy believes that everybody in the city should come out. Everybody in the city has an investment in the Olympics. Their public funds are being spent and their lives are being negatively impacted. So we hope to see a lot of people out on Friday with Squatchy marching to BC Place to welcome the opening ceremonies.
And what message do you hope that people, you know, either visitors who are coming here who wander by or people that, you know, watch the coverage, what message do you hope that they take away from all this?
The Olympics are not the sanitized, nice corporate image that they appear to be. The Olympics are one of the most expensive things that a city can do. The Olympics are one of the things that can have the most negative impacts on poor people and even middle-class people in a city that any municipality can ever have. I hope people that go home with an impression of the Olympics similar to that the people in Chicago had when they said, when Obama wanted to go over and get the Olympics for Chicago, hell no, we don't want this. That's what we're hoping that people will get out of this, to make sure that the Olympics do not succeed in continuing to perpetuate this image that they are this nice thing that's just all about sports. This is about corporatization, this is about nationalism, this is about the displacement of poor people. That's what this is about.
No, you do. I'm going to say it.
Can you tell us more about...
Squatchy would like to mention, too, that we're trying to show some solidarity with former and future Olympic host cities. If you look at the history of other host cities, they've really suffered from having the Olympics. Squatchy's familiar with this from talking to their mascots. They felt exploited. They were depressed afterwards. They were neglected by the promotional division. And additionally, we have other host cities coming forward. Chicago lucked out, and they escaped the curse of the Olympics. But London and Sochi are going to have the Olympics crammed down their throats. So we want to show solidarity with those communities.
Can you tell us what's being organized at the UBC campus when the torch comes?
Yeah.
At 3 o'clock, we're going to have a little movie showing, and then after that, we're going to have some sign-making things. At around 5 o'clock, we're going to go out, and we're going to have a rally at the actual Olympic celebration carnival thing that the university is putting on, and we're going to be there when the torch goes by with our messages. We're going to be starting at 5 o'clock at the Goddess of Democracy. That's a little statue that's right outside the Student Union building there. It's a traditional site of protest that was erected after the Tiananmen Square demonstrations.
And that was the Olympic Resistance Network's press conference this morning at the Vancouver Art Gallery to discuss the February 12th Take Back Our City protest, as well as other activities they are organizing. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, and right now it's time for our weekday weather forecast, and for that we go to Daniel Casanova.
Thanks, Andrew. Well, you better enjoy the sunny breaks while they last, for we'll be back to cloudy skies later in the week. A huge low-pressure system is currently hitting the Gulf of Alaska, and we're expecting to see some light residue from the storm make its way to Vancouver on Wednesday. By Friday, we will be getting warm, moist air coming up from the mid-Pacific, so we will be experiencing periods of rain and increasing temperatures towards the end of the week. And here's the weekday outlook. For tonight, we will have cloudy periods with a low of 3 degrees. Tomorrow, it will be sunny with some cloudy periods, a high of 8 degrees, and a low of 2. On Wednesday, it will be cloudy with 30% chance of isolated showers, high of 7 degrees, low of 3. For Thursday, we will experience rainy periods with a high of 7 and low of 3 degrees. And finally, for Friday, expect rainy periods as well, but with a high of 10 degrees and a low of 6. Currently, it is partly cloudy at YVR Airport and 8 degrees. That's this week's weather forecast, brought to you by the UBC Storm Club. For News 101, I'm Daniel Casanova.
And thank you, Daniel, for that forecast. We're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, we'll be offering you the best of our previous Olympics coverage. Make sure you stay tuned to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. This is News 101.
On the sunny west coast of the nation, this is Kid Koala, and you're listening to CITR in Vancouver on 101.9 FM.
The freshest acts in electronic entertainment are coming to Code Live. 3 weekends, 8 shows in Vancouver's newest multimedia concert space. Friday, February 12th, celebrated DJ Kid Koala brings a special turntable cabaret show to the Center for Digital Media, 3 blocks east of the Main Street Science World SkyTrain station. Montreal's Kid Koala, tickets $22. Call 1-800-TICKETS or tickets.com. Code. It's the Cultural Olympiad's digital edition. For more info, visit vancouver2010.com/code.
CITR News is committed to providing you with in-depth Olympic coverage from an alternative perspective. As part of this coverage, we are launching a new Eyes on the Street feature, where Vancouverites will have a chance to tell their Olympic story. We want to hear your perspective on life in Vancouver during the Games. That's why we're inviting you to be CITR's Eyes on the Street this February. If you're at an event, a protest, a celebration, or even simply on the bus, tell us about it. There are 3 ways to file a report. Call our Eyes on the Street hotline at 604-822-5334. Email news at citr.ca or tweet CITR News. Then sit back and wait for your report to be featured on the next edition of News 101, which airs Monday and Friday at 5 p.m. right here on CITR, 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
And thanks for being with us. You're listening to News 101 on CITR, 101.9 FM in Vancouver. The current time is 5:34. Now we're going to turn to our best of Olympics, pre-Olympics coverage. We've got a number of clips and stories for you today, showcasing the coverage that we've done over the last year on our pre-Olympics coverage. So we're going to first start off with a clip from Chris Shaw speaking at the Green College Lecture Series that they held this past fall, and he's going to be discussing the background. Discussing background on key players that were involved in the Olympic bid and giving us some background to the Olympics. And here that clip is. On Monday, October 5th, Professor Christopher Shaw spoke at Green College at UBC as part of the ongoing Olympic Critics Speaker Series. He is a professor at UBC and is the author of Five Ring Circus, Myths and Realities of the Olympic Games. His lecture, entitled The Hidden Fourth Pillar of the Olympic Games, Privatized Profit, Socialized Debt, touched on a variety of issues related to the Olympic Games. He primarily spoke about the supposed public benefits of hosting the Games. Professor Shaw first speaks about those most involved in pushing for the Olympic bid.
This gentleman, his name is Jack Poole. He is the CEO of VANOC. Before that, he was the CEO of the Bid Corps, which is the organization that brought us the Games. And in a candid moment, he has a few, in a candid moment, he got up in front of a bunch of developers, I think it was in Squamish in 2002, and also, unfortunately, some reporters were there, and he said if the Games weren't coming, we'd have to invent something. And what he meant by that, we think, was that they needed some sort of means to get you and me to invest in their private deals. Because all the things that this gentleman had done over the years, and this, by the way, this is his partner in crime, a fellow named David Podmore, who's now the CEO of Concert Properties. Concert Properties, before it was Concert Properties, was something called Greystone, which was trying to get the convention center downtown and was trying to do different deals. And before that, it was something called Vancouver Land Corporation, which managed to get the city of Vancouver to sell them for $10 a 99-year lease on almost 100 acres of property along waterfront land. One councillor at the time, Jonathan Baker, called it the greatest land deal since the Dutch bought Manhattan from the Indians for $24 of junk jewelry. Concert Properties, Concert Properties is the new incarnation. Jack managed, in the course of various previous companies he had run, he had lost his investors $3 billion, which you'd think would not be an enormously enticing thing for other people to want to invest in, certainly not to make this guy the head of a multi-billion dollar project. And yet back in the early 80s, this gentleman was approached by none other than Gordon Campbell. Gordon Campbell was then the mayor of Vancouver, and Gordon Campbell, I think most of you are familiar with his politics and his policies, Gordon Campbell decided that he urgently needed social housing in Vancouver. That was just a priority for him as mayor. And he turned to Jack Poole, who was retiring, and he was retiring because his investors had kicked him out of the companies he'd destroyed, and he said, Jack, I want you to start a new corporation. We're going to call it Vancouver Land Corporation. We're going to fund it with city money, provincial money, and union pension funds, and you're going to run it, and you're going to build social housing. Well, guess what they didn't build? Okay, but anyway, that was the beginning of Vancouver Land Corporation. So what did Concert Properties and its previous incarnations want when they were Greystone? They wanted a new convention center. They tried to push that deal through from way back in this was through the 90s. Ultimately, the NDP government rejected it because the cost was going to be over the top insane. And guess what actually happened? They got the convention center, and the cost was over the top insane. What was supposed to be almost a $480 million project became almost a $900 million project. Okay. They wanted ski resort development in the Callahan Valley. Guess what they're going to get? They wanted developments along the Sea to Sky Highway along the corridor to Whistler. If you've driven that corridor lately, you know that's exactly what's happening up and down the corridor. And, of course, they wanted ultimately to control the Athletes' Village, and we know that because these guys actually made a bid on it, even though Mr. Poole had said back before the Games were awarded that Concert Properties had no financial interest in anything associated with the Olympics, it wouldn't bid on anything. And 2 years later, he put a bid on the village. Other developers, what did they want? They wanted to gentrify the downtown east side. They wanted the same thing, the Sea to Sky corridor enhanced. They wanted to develop, there were many ski resort attempts to try and piggyback on the backs of the Olympics, whether they were in the Melvin Creek, also called Shutika, where there's been a blockade since 2000, at Chiam, down in the valley, and at Brome Ridge near Squamish. And, of course, they wanted an airport connector, a new subway line from the airport into downtown Vancouver. And these items, the new convention center, the Sea to Sky Highway upgrade, and the RAB, or Canada Line Connector, were all essential to getting the bid. They were considered to be absolute must-haves if we're going to get the bid. So what does the IOC get? Well, the IOC basically gets a lot of money is what they get. They don't pay income taxes on this planet. Anyway, they don't pay income taxes in Canada, the host country. The federal government snuck a clause into the 2007 federal budget that made them tax exempt as a non-profit organization. They don't pay taxes in Vancouver. They don't pay taxes in the province of British Columbia. And they sure as heck do not pay taxes in Switzerland, because Switzerland also curiously considers them a non-profit organization. they have enormous amount of privilege. Andrew Jennings, who will be speaking later in the series, will tell you about it. And they live like the new kings of the universe. So in it, what's in it for them? A lot of money and a lot of prestige and power.
Professor Shaw then goes on to debunk the myth that the games are a moneymaker for both the province and the host city.
Basically, there is very little money to be made in the Olympics if you count all the costs. If you do purely economic impacts and you don't look at all the costs, you don't look at the infrastructure you have to build, you don't look at the super projects that you have to do because the IOC wants them, and you don't look at the security costs, and we'll come back to security costs, you're not going to make any money. And there is a new study that just came out, just released, as far as I know, on last Thursday from Western University that is going to make that point even more clearly. So again, those are your numbers. That's what you could possibly get. And then they estimated tourism from various estimates. Again, there's your kind of medium high. You could get 2.7 million tourists coming to the province of BC during this time. But the caveats, again, are these. Okay, so sure, even if you want to double it and say the out-of-province thing is going to be the numbers we just saw, the in-province thing could be at least as big, so double the numbers you've just heard, but it didn't measure the positive impacts against the costs required to obtain them, as a cost-benefit analysis would do. Okay. And again, cost-benefit analysis, a true cost-benefit analysis, would not only look at the economic numbers, it would consider the impact on the environment, it would consider the impact on the poor, it would consider the impact on things such as what we call opportunity costs. What happens if you don't build the community? What if you use that money for something else? So, this is the latest report that was just released, an article called Olympic Caveats, Host Cities, Risk, Debt, and Scandal by Howard Burks, released on October 1st. Basically said, if money-making were an Olympic event, no city hosting the Games would win a gold medal, or silver, or bronze. That's a pretty safe, pretty clear statement. And it's based on a study by Robert Barney of the Center for Olympic Studies at Western University, who blatantly says there's never been an Olympic Games that has made a profit. And I think Mr. Barney is correct. And that flies in the face of most of the stuff we've been told. We've been told that Los Angeles made a profit. It did, but only if you look at the operating period. We've been told that Calgary made a profit. It made a marginal profit. We've been told that Barcelona got a new port, which it did, but for a huge capital outlay. So these things are highlighted as this is your Nigerian banking scam. You can make this profit if you only open up your bank account. If you gamble with your money, you can actually make a lot of money. But again, the numbers, if you go back in history and look at across the board, you are very unlikely to do so. In fact, you're likely to lose a lot of money. So let's do a reality check. The promises in 2002, and there were a lot of promises made by Bidcorp and later by Vanoc. We were told that the overall cost to taxpayers, provincial and federal, were going to be something around about $660 million. That was going to be all in, everything. Okay. We were told, Larry Campbell said this, the games won't cost Vancouver one penny. Well, as we'll see, Larry may actually have been telling the truth because it's a little bit more than a penny, but let's say he meant it as not costing anything. As Richard Daley in Chicago just recently told his citizens before his bid got kicked out of the park, that it wouldn't cost Chicagoans a dime. Vanoc's business plan had the fundamental assumption, and it was stated in the business plan, which was released, by the way, 3 years late, that the economy will continue to be strong through 2010. Which was a kind of an amazing statement to be making at the time, considering that people such as Alan Greenspan had been talking about this irrational exuberance and the problem of the markets, and the problem, furthermore, that the subprime industry was likely to take down the entire real estate industry in North America, as it did. And it's not as if this stuff wasn't known. It's not as if people didn't realize that the economy had real issues, that you could go into a recession. But Vanoc, in building his business plan, and this is unusual for a business plan, and I've built business plans before, Vanoc, for its business plan, didn't have any range of outcomes. They didn't say, okay, here's how great it could be, here's how bad it could be, and here's the middle course. They had, no, just the happy, happy, joy, joy, that everything's going to be perfect through 2010, leaving aside all this other stuff, and that things, that all it can possibly do, the rose-colored glasses firmly planted on their faces, that's one option. The other one is that they're lying. And that all of these things can only generate money, and the economy can only improve. These were things that were essential: the convention center, airport connector, and the See the Sky Highway had to be happening for the games. The IOC told Vanoc and the government in no uncertain terms, well, it was Bidcorp at the time, no uncertain terms, that it needed to be able to get to Whistler faster. Therefore, improve the highway. And as always, organizers bow and immediately go obey the IOC. They were told, for example, that the mega construction projects would boost the economy, but it comes back to our first question, is that the way to build an economy? That it would help the poor and the homeless, and this is a bit of the Milton Friedman-esque oats through the horse feeding the sparrows idea, and that security costs were trivial, nothing, practically free, $175 million. And that they would make sure that native symbols and culture were an integral part of the games. So what? 7 years later, what do we see? Well, the cost that we know about, and I want to emphasize know about, because we don't know all of the amounts of money spent. What we know about is about $6 billion.
And that was Chris Shaw speaking at the Green College Lecture Series. Now we're going to listen to a clip from Mayor Gregor Robertson. I interviewed the mayor after the reopening of the Kolch in East Vancouver. And this is what he had to say about how the arts community will be affected by the Olympics. Do you see the Olympics as posing a problem to artists in the city and possibly pushing them further out?
No, I see the Olympics more on the opportunity side for artists. I think we have an opportunity to really shine as a center for arts and culture. And I think that'll be a big theme in the Olympics with the Cultural Olympiad and with hundreds of thousands of visitors here seeing the work of our artists and our performance here for the first time. I think it's big exposure, and from that I think it creates opportunity for our artists.
And that was Mayor Gregor Robertson speaking to me after the reopening of the Kolch in East Vancouver, and he did not see the Olympics as having a negative impact on artists in the community. Now we're going to listen to a clip from reporter Kate Hughes. On Friday, January 22nd, our own news reporter, News 101 reporter Kate Hughes, spoke with Ed Durgan of the Social Justice Center here at UBC. It's a campus coalition that is united to address the convergence of the 2010 Olympic Games on campus here at UBC. Kate asked him about their third annual Rethinking the Olympics conference, the Killer Coat campaign, and corporate advertising in Vancouver. Here's some of that conversation.
The SJC is kind of the de facto representative of the 2010 Welcoming Committee, mm-hmm. which is a group of activist organizations in Vancouver, the BC area, that are organizing in resistance to the Olympics. And yesterday we hosted David Zirin, who's a radical sports writer, who spoke about politics and sports. And that's kind of leading up to next week's conference, Rethinking the Olympics, which is a series of workshops and panels and a party that we're putting together to try to broaden the dialogue on campus, which for the most part UBC has uncritically accepted everything Olympics. Mm-hmm. We think there's a lot that's very wrong with that. And so we're trying to subvert the dialogue a bit and broaden the dialogue to include a solid and rigorous critique of the Olympics.
Uh-huh. In particular, we're really interested in the Coca-Cola case film that I think you're showing on January the 28th at the Norm Theatre. Why do you think that this is important to show in terms of the Olympics and Coke being the official sponsor?
Well, yeah, Coca-Cola is one of the official corporate sponsors of the Olympics, among many others, which are also, you know, well-known violators of human rights, arms manufacturers, big pharmaceuticals, things like that. The SJC this year is in charge of Cinema Politica. And we had a few films to choose from for that particular slot. We chose the Coke film because they are an Olympic sponsor. Mm-hmm. And it coincided, that Thursday coincided with the Rethinking the Olympics conference. The Killer Coke case is something that's really well known amongst in activist circles, and in fact years ago it was the main campaign of the Social Justice Center here at UBC. Mm-hmm. A few years ago, so it was kind of a no-brainer to pick the Coca-Cola case for us, since it just became available. It's a new film.
Mm-hmm.
And we want to highlight the human rights abuses that Coke has perpetrated in South America, particularly where, you know, it's well known that Coca-Cola has engaged in union-busting practices to the extreme, where they're actually hiring paramilitary goons to kill, to assassinate union labor organizers and to terrorize their families and the communities in which they're trying to build build a coalition of workers to unionize workers to improve conditions, human rights conditions down there.
Yeah, right. Yeah. That's interesting.
And that was News 101 reporter Kate Hughes talking to Ed Durgan, an organizer with the Social Justice Center on campus here at UBC. We're going to now go to a clip with David Eby of the BCCLA. In November, News co-director Brad Pepink had the opportunity to... Excuse me. We're not going to be going to David Eby. We'll be going to an interview with Tim Chu. He was the AMS VP External, and he's going to be discussing the AMS's relationship with UBC and VanOck. They spoke about, among many things, students' rights during the games and the relationship, often not the best relationship that the AMS has had with VanOck. Here's what Tim had to say to News co-director Brad Pepink.
Discuss that relationship that the AMS has with the institution, you know, as the student representative body, what kind of relationship you are experiencing with UBC and kind of the proxy with VanOck.
Mm-hmm. We've been in constant dialogue with the university. We've been asking them some of the questions in regards to the planning, and they've only been telling us things that have been finalized. So we haven't been in that planning process to mitigate some of the concerns that students might have. We're worried that, for example, the transportation plan that hasn't been released yet, students still need access to research facilities to tend to their crystals or whatever research they're doing. And we're scared that the university doesn't recognize that and students won't be able to access their research facilities because of road closures. Like I said, we've been in constant dialogue with the university. A lot of the times we've been trying to get into the planning meetings, but that hasn't really happened. They try to restrict us with the confidentiality thing, saying that, yes, you can come to these meetings, but you can't tell anybody what we're doing. And we felt as the AMS that that was inappropriate because we have an obligation to go and tell our constituents, our students, the 45,000 students that we represent here at the AMS, what is happening. So we didn't feel that that was appropriate. So we chose not to sign that confidentiality
right.
agreement thing.
Okay. And that was a decision by the AMS as a whole.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so could we expect any further action that the AMS may take to continue this dialogue with mm-hmm. the institution?
Definitely. Under my portfolio, I have hired an Olympics and Paralympics commissioner. He's the one that's sort of responsible with the dialogue for in regards to the Olympics with the university and other appropriate bodies. Okay. And we've been constantly asking the questions and asking where these security zones are going to be and what students can expect during the games.
And that was News co-director Brad Pepink speaking to Tim Chu, AMS VP External, about the AMS's relationship with VanOck and the university. We're now going to hear a clip of David Eby, and this takes us way back to September 2009. The BCCLA and Pivot Legal Society launched their Legal Observer campaign, and News co-director Brad Pepink spoke with executive director of the BCCLA, David Eby, about his concerns with VanOck's intentions regarding freedom of expression. Here's that conversation and also him discussing what the Legal Observer program is and why it's necessary.
David Eby, and here to speak with him, Brad Pepink.
Thanks, Carrie. A press release from the Vancouver Olympic Organizing Committee, or VanOck, dated September 16th, is facing heated criticism from the BC Civil Liberties Association. The press release serves as VanOck's explicit regulations regarding freedom of expression during the 2010 Olympic Games. According to the release, VanOck and its partners respect every citizen's right to freedom of expression as protected by Canadian law, end quote. But this trust us attitude isn't enough, according into the BCCLA. As well, the BCCLA is hoping to have more than 100 pairs of eyeballs trained to observe the observers, referring, of course, to VanOck's Integrated Security Unit, who will be patrolling Olympic venues with full freedom to remove any political, religious, or racial propaganda. Again, we have BCCLA Executive Director David Eby on the line to tell us about VanOck's ongoing stance on freedom of expression. Hi, Mr. Eby. Thanks for joining us today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
To start, the BCCLA has recently teamed up with Pivot Legal Society to train legal observers who will monitor potential rights violations during the Olympic Games. Can you tell us why these legal observers will be necessary?
Well, the need for the observers has really come from the gap between the official messages that we're getting from VanOck and from the City of Vancouver and from the Integrated Security Unit, and the contracts and the documents that they signed in the bid process and in the agreements around the Olympics that are full of anti-free speech provisions.
And specifically, could you mention or could you describe some of the VanOck stipulations regarding freedom of expression that BCCLA and Pivot Legal Society find concerning?
Absolutely. So they're numerous and they vary. So, for example, VanOck mailed out an illustrated brochure to cities across Canada that are participating in the Torch Run, outlining activities of concern. And one of those activities of concerns that VanOck invited the cities to crack down on was the distribution of political literature by politicians. And one would assume the distribution of political literature by non-politicians or activist organizations or anybody else who wanted to hand out a pamphlet that wasn't an official Olympic sponsor. In the host city agreement, which is the contract that governs the relationship between VanOck and the International Olympic Committee and the City of Vancouver, the City of Vancouver then Mayor Larry Campbell signed this contract, and it says expressly that protests and political materials will not be in view of the international media or the spectators attending the Olympic events at venues in Vancouver. In addition, we have a clean venue agreement that sets out when spectators at the Olympic Games will be removed because their clothing have political messages. The clean venue agreement also sets out that VanOck is going to be setting out teams of their own brand police, who are apparently mostly volunteers, that will be identifying and apparently attempting to seize brand violation materials that they identify throughout the City of Vancouver. So all of these and more are causing us this concern.
And that was BCCLA Executive Director David Eby speaking to News Co-Director Brad Pepink back in September of 2009 about the Legal Observers program that they were launching for the Olympics. So that ends our best of pre. Oh, sorry. We're going to actually be listening to a clip of Harsha Walia. She is a local Vancouver activist, very involved in the downtown east side. She's going to be talking about the security presence and the long-term implications about the increased security and militarization of the downtown east side and of Vancouver in a larger context. Also about the bylaw ticketing that has increased with the arrival of the Olympics, and also talking about the Olympics as coercion and a form of forced relocation. Here's that clip from Harsha Walia.
The VPD plans to use tactical armored vehicles costing $192,000 each. And Sergeant Norm Webster of the VPD has explicitly stated when asked if these armored vehicles will be used only for the Olympics and what the plans are for after that. He explicitly stated, quote, "I would like to have these in place for the Olympics, but it isn't just because of that. I plan on using them afterwards as well." The RCMP plans to erect at least 40 kilometers of electronically monitored security fencing, including sensors and video cameras around at least 25 Olympic venues. So all of this is just kind of a very general, broad overview of some of the specific security measures that we can expect to see in the lead up to the games in the next couple of months. I'm going to return to talking a little bit more about this security apparatus in just a second in terms of some of the broader implications. I wanted to focus really quickly in terms of what we're already seeing very close to here in the neighborhood that is the poorest off-reserve neighborhood in Canada, which is the downtown east side. And people are probably very familiar, EB's already mentioned some of them, And this is really important to highlight because what we see with the Olympics, of course, we know the downtown East Side is already subjected to a constant environment of surveillance, police violence, harassment, high-level policing. It's the only neighborhood where beat cops are present on a regular basis. So beat cops are cops who just patrol the neighborhood. We're seeing an increase in beat cops with the Olympics on a weekly basis. That number is increasing. And some of the specific measures include the aggressive bylaw ticketing that we saw last year, which was ticketing for bylaw infractions. So for things like jaywalking, spitting, so-called illegal vending, which is just vending without a business license, which you and I do if we ever have a garage sale. That's illegal vending, but of course only selectively enforced in the downtown East Side. And the number of tickets that were given out for bylaw infractions, so these are, again, really petty, minor infractions that people are deliberately ticketed for in order to make sure that people are, one, intimidated, and two, under the guise of the intimidation, will start to move out of the neighborhood and move into more darker corners and areas of Vancouver that are outside what will soon form the tourist kind of core in Vancouver. In 2008, the number of tickets between provincial bylaw tickets and municipal bylaw tickets was close to 2,000 tickets in just the downtown East Side core, which is, you know, a four-block radius. In 2009, the statistics from January till July already show that the number of tickets have exceeded the number of tickets in 2008. So this kind of aggressive ticketing, although Mayor Gregor Robertson and the VPD like to tell us that this ticketing is not being done in the lead up to the Olympics, that has nothing to do with the Olympics, it's to keep people safe, you know, this perverse, constant perverse logic that everything that represses us is actually to keep us safe, is something that we hear constantly. So that's continuing in the lead up to the games. And it's really common to hear people incredibly worried about what the downtown East Side will look like in the lead up to the Olympic Games, and people talking about physically moving, you know, and that we can say this relocation is not forced, but it arguably is incredibly forced because it's a form of coercion, although it may seem more subtle, but it's a form of coercion that forces people to leave their neighborhoods. And this is coupled with, of course, the ongoing gentrification in the neighborhood, the increasing amounts of homelessness that we're experiencing all across BC, but specifically in the downtown East Side.
And that was Vancouver activist Harsha Walia discussing the security presence and the impacts of the games on the downtown East Side especially, and looking at the Olympics as a form of coercion and forced relocation. And that's our program for February 8th, 2010. Thanks for tuning in. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, give us a hot news tip, or get involved with the show, contact us. Our phone number is 604-822-5334, or you can email news@citr.ca. Be sure to follow us on Twitter @CITRNews and subscribe to our podcast at www.citr.ca. Brad Pepping produced this radio program. For more news, join us this Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. We will be bringing you live